Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Windsor, Canada, and fell in love with the guitar and music at age 9. At age 21, he bought a flute from a street person for $9. A world-class classical, jazz, and pop flautist, he performs 100-plus concerts each year. Other than Hiram Walker whiskey, he is Windsor's greatest gift to America. His name, the famous Alexander Zonchick, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Alexander Zonchick, a world-class classical jazz and pop flautist who performs 100-plus concerts each year. Alexander, yes. Welcome. A real honor to have you.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Jack. I like the plus, because that could mean anything. It could be 100 plus another 100. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank
we
you
We go
so
back
much.
A long time, and this will be quite a show.
The familiarity could get in the way of the show.
Can we start by talking about your mom and your dad and your childhood?
Well, I was really lucky. You know, it's so funny, because growing up, there were people would tell us we were poor, and we never really related to it, because we were rich in all the right things and poor in others, certainly. We never owned a car. We grew up in Windsor, Ontario. My mother and father never owned a car. So why we buy a car? There's buses, you know. And so it was a wonderful inner city. My mother spoke 9 languages fluently. My mother and father met speaking Italian. So we grew up in this really mixed a neighborhood, and it was so much fun. It was a little confusing now and then. Had a grandmother who lived with us, who taught me how to speak fluent Greek, and they were just so supportive, just hardworking. We had the greatest examples in the world. Every day we saw them go out and come back, and their priorities were just so clear: food,
speaking
God,
of,
and carpeting.
Speaking of great examples, what's the biggest thing Mom taught you, and what's the biggest thing Dad taught you?
Well, certainly my mom, it was all giving. Our house was central, like mission control in the city. When anyone came from the old country, which is what we called it in the 50s, they all found their way to my mother's house. And I grew up just seeing her helping people, getting them jobs. Oh, I'll get you a job at the hospital. Here's where you need to go to get food. And so that's just been ingrained. Totally. And with my dad, of course, the work ethic was amazing. He just never stopped working. I discovered it late. It was very funny, because early in my life, I thought I was just a guy who wanted to play the guitar. I found out later that there was this huge discipline and this real perseverance, definitely from my dad. Just the hardest working guy, and honest to the point where it would drive you crazy. You don't have to admit that, Dad. They don't know about that. And no. And he was a very principled guy. I could go on and on, like most of us, about our parents and how important they are. But they meant everything to me. I wish they were both still here.
Where did you get your love for music?
Accidentally. You know, I've been lucky enough. You know, I've did radio and I've done a lot of interviews through the years. And it's very funny. More often than not, when you interview, in some cases famous, in some cases not famous musicians, the musician doesn't find the instrument. The instrument finds the musician. It seems it's the other way around. There's all this serendipity, you know. And I've interviewed so many people, and they've almost learned by default. There was a wonderful man in downtown Windsor named Frank Haneke, who had a school of music, and he would go into the inner city, these poor neighborhoods, and give music aptitude tests to all the kids downtown. And of course, no one failed the music aptitude test, because the reason for the test was, well, I just gave your son a test, and he really should be taking music lessons. That's the way it kind of worked. One of those folks, Frank Haneke, came to my house, and my brother was home, not me, gave my brother a music aptitude test. I came home, and my brother said, I'm going to be taking guitar lessons. And I was getting a little jealous, and I go, well, let's see how this works out. 6 months later, he's taking the lessons, but whenever the guitar was lying around, I would play it. My mother, being the intelligent woman that she was, said, how come the guy who's not taking the lessons plays better guitar than the guy who's taking the lessons? And my brother said, well, maybe he should take the lessons. And so I started by default and totally fell in love with the idea of of music and playing. I can't count the hours alone in those rooms with the fantasies and thinking of big audiences in front of you. And so there's where it started. There's where the love started. There was no professional musicians in my family, although I had an uncle, Uncle George, who played accordion, and he played by ear, and he played harmonica. And so we did have that music in the house. So it's thank God to my brother that he quit.
At age 8, you had your first playing song. What was it?
You know, I love how prepared you are, Jack. This is so good. Well, you know, here's what happened. I'm playing the guitar. I'm not really playing songs. And when you first, and your mother would come in, and not having any formal training in music herself, she would say to me, you need to learn a song. And then she said to me one day, you know, if you know anything about Greeks and Greek culture, one pretty famous song is Never on Sunday. I got the flute here. I'll play it for you. You know, that was from the famous movie, Never on Sunday. And she came to me, and she sat at the end of my bed. She goes, we're going to learn how to play Never on Sunday today, Alec. Aleko, that was my little Greek name. And I goes, well, explain to me why I want to learn how to play the Everly Brothers. I want to learn how to play the Ventures. She says, you learn with, I'll try the accent. Alec, you learn how to play Never on Sunday. Every time the Greek friends come over and the relatives, you play Never on Sunday. They'll give you money. And I kind of looked at her and goes, you got to be kidding me. So she sat note by note and taught me how to play that. We just picked it out on the guitar. And, of course, you know, the story goes that, you know, 12 years later, I raised $480,000 from Greek relatives. But every time they came over, there was the quarter. I'm like, quick, go get the guitar. You know, that was pretty magical when I think
about
it.
And you still got that first quarter.
I still got the first quarter. I can still play Never on Sunday. It doesn't work for me anymore.
We're with the famous Alexander Zonchick, who told us a couple minutes ago that the instrument finds the person. Boy, is that true in his life. We'll talk about that when we come back. And I'm Jack Brasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Brasula, and we're with Alexander Zonchick, who told us in the previous segment that the instrument finds the person. And boy, was that true in 1972 for you and the flute.
Well, absolutely, Jack. You know, I love about this story. It's been told so many times. You know what happens when a story gets told so many times? It changes.
You start to believe it.
Well, you mean the guy who tells it?
Yeah.
That is just so funny. Imagine I find out on Jack's show that the story's not even true. That would be just so funny. It's an interesting story. I was playing in Toronto in a rock and roll band, really thinking I was doing okay. You know, I left the city, played fairly good guitar. I was really young. I joined a band in Toronto called Crosstown Traffic was the name of the band. Had lots of fun, toured with these guys. They were all older. I'm home visiting my parents. My mother still really doesn't know what I do for a living. What are you doing in Toronto? You know, I said, well, I play the guitar. People give me money. Just like Never on Sunday. It's the same story. But I was actually walking down the street. It was Elliott Street. I remember the street. And a guy approached me like they approach you on the street to sell you a watch or to sell you anything. He knew I was the guitar player, so I don't want this to sound that big of a stretch. He goes, hey, you're the guitar player, right? And I got the big fro, and I'm, you know, I'm about 90 pounds soaking wet at that time. And he says, I hear you're doing really good in Toronto. He goes, hey, I got a flute here. Would you like to buy a flute? And it was so odd to me. I goes, would I like to buy a flute? And he opened it up. I loved how it looked in the case. You know, the three parts, the head joint, the foot joint, the body. I said, how much do you want? He says, $50. I goes, I've only got $9. I'll take it. And obviously, the fair question to ask is, was it hot? Well, yes. He actually had borrowed it or somehow acquired it from a local high school. Ironically enough, the high school I went to, Patterson Collegiate Institute, it had PCI engraved in it. And then you ask, why didn't you take it back? By that point, the school was torn down, and it's now a grocery store. So I had no intention of taking a $9 flute into the produce section and giving it back. But that's how it started. And I fell in love, not with even the idea initially of playing it. I loved the way it looked. And then when I finally got it home, here comes, and here's the instrument finding the guy. Here's another thing that I found. I found this, I had it with the guitar a little bit, but not as much with the flute. When I took that flute home, I could not stop trying to get a sound out of it. It's a very difficult instrument to play. And I guess the rest is sort of history. Fell in love with playing it, auditioned for the University of Windsor Music Department. Somehow they accepted me. I mean, this is 8 months later. The prerequisite for a university classical studies program is not I bought a flute off a guy in the street, you know, 8 months ago. There were a few professors there that I think saw something, which was the passion, I think, that was at that audition, and heard something. And I remember Imre Rosnyai, this great Hungarian professor, clarinet player, looked at me and just really sensed something. He goes, you know, you like to perform, don't you? You know, with that, he sounded like Dracula, you know. And it was, boy, what an amazing journey that set me on. I'd never played classical music before. I fell in love with classical music, obsessed with learning how to get sounds out of that flute, and not even a fantasy that anyone would ever pay me to play the flute. I understood the guitar.
So. Alexander, when you die and you're in front of St. Peter, and he says, Alexander, did you ever pay retail for anything in your life? What are you going to tell St. Peter? What's retail?
I'm going to tell him I got a discount getting in here. That's what I'm going to tell him.
All right. How did the British invasion of the 60s influence your dreams and your future?
Well, boy, you could ask that question of a lot of us that came out of that era. It profoundly, not only on a musical level, because the music was amazing. You know, did we really know what we were growing up in? Did we know that that was so special? Did we know later that Motown was so special? Did we all know that? We were just lucky enough to grow through it. For me, it was big. And the thing that was interesting with me, I was already playing the guitar before the British invasion. So I loved the Everly Brothers, and I loved the Ventures, and I loved some of the country artists at the time because I learned how to play their songs. So when the Beatles came along, and of course I love telling this story because it's one of the worst predictions I've ever made in my entire life. I'm already playing at Dougal Avenue School, and my early performances are on stage at these Friday assemblies where they would put me in front of the whole school, and I would play cowboy songs. I'd play the Popeye song, Sailor's Hornpipe, you know, and it was really quite magical. When the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, the next day I was in music class with Mr. Ramsey, my music teacher. And of course, he kind of thought of me as a little bit of an expert. Imagine I'm in like grade 4 or 5. And he goes, Alex, did you see the Beatles on Ed Sullivan last night? I goes, yeah, I saw them. You know, what did you think? And of course, maybe with a little jealousy, you know, and the fact that I liked the Everly Brothers and the Beatles were new, I said to Mr. Ramsey, they're not going anywhere.
And 60 years later, they're still here.
Well, you know, it was, but they were an amazing influence. I'm a huge Beatle fan. Dave Clark 5, all of those groups that came out of that time, I just thought it was a magical time.
And the late, great Ernie Harwell would have said, and the Everly Brothers are long gone. All right, you mentioned Motown. What was it like growing up in Windsor across the Detroit River at the height of the Motown era?
Magic, absolutely magic. And of course, you know, if I might mention another radio station, the Big Eight was everything. You know, it was CKLW, and it at that point a powerful, powerful station. And we just grew up living and breathing that music in a real multicultural area. You know, Windsor, a lot like Detroit, maybe smaller, just totally in love. And when I first started to play in little bands, you know, I'm 13 years old. I'm already playing in a band called The Fugitives. And here it is, all these years later, I'm still a fugitive. No. We would play dances, big dances at Riverside Arena. And at that time, Dave Schaefer and all these famous disc jockeys would bring in the famous Motown stars to pantomime their hits. So I was lucky enough at 13 and 14 years old to play dances where the Four Tops and little Stevie Wonder at the time were there. That music meant everything to us. It's still in me.
Alexander, God regularly brings angels in each of our lives. Two such angels in your life have been Irvin Monroe and Bob James.
Absolutely. I was a huge Bob James fan going to university. There was something about the way he brought together classical music and jazz. He had a very broad palette. He studied classical. He was an amazing jazz musician, wrote all that famous music for the TV show Taxi. He was playing at the Royal Oak Music Theater, and one of my big breaks in late 81 was I finally got an opportunity to play at Baker's Keyboard Lounge. Back then, Baker's Keyboard Lounge was a career move. You would follow Dizzy Gillespie into that room. So when I finally got an opportunity to play in there, it was a huge, wonderful weekend for me. Now, I'm in there playing. Bob James is playing at the Royal Oak Music Theater. I can't go because I'm playing. An agent friend of mine, Jerry Varga, who passed away, went to that concert at the Royal Oak Music Theater, and at the end of Bob's concert said to Bob, went backstage because he knew Bob's manager, said, "Bob, I've got this guy I want you to hear." You know, he says, "I don't usually go out after a show because you got to come to Baker's with me because there's a flute player there and I want you to meet him. I know you like flute music, you know." And he had his daughter with him, Hillary, who talked him into going. Said, "Come on, Dad, don't be such a party pooper. Let's go out." She was only 13 at the time. And next thing you know, I'm at Baker's Keyboard Lounge. I'm playing, and there's these mirrors all around the table, all around the room. And I look in a mirror, and I see this guy come in. I goes, "That looks like Bob James." It completely freaked me out. Can you imagine one of your heroes just walks into this little room? Well, all of a sudden, I just started playing every Bob James song that I knew. I mean, I thought, it's got to be Bob James. And it was magic. I finished that set. Bob came up to the stage. I didn't go to him. And he come up, shook my hand. He goes, "You know, I've been hearing so much about you." It was a shock to me that he even knew who I was. And I went and sat down with him. We had a quick chat. He says, "You know, coming up this next spring, I'm taking this incredible band on a tour to Japan. And when we get back, we're going to play Carnegie Hall. Would you like to join the band?" It was that simple. And it was like, give me 2 seconds to think about this. I'll be happy if I can just get you guys coffee. Really, I'm not kidding. I left that Baker's with my feet 5 feet off the ground that night. And it started a relationship that's lasted to this day. He's an amazing artist, a mentor, someone who continues to inspire all of us. He's 75 years old today, still going strong as can be. And so you brought up two really special people. I think if you're lucky enough to know one in your life, to have as many, you know, it's pretty special.
If you want to learn more, www.zonchick.com. ZONJIC.com. And here's Alexander playing a bit of Angela. Angela by Alexander Zonchick, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasul, and we're with the amazing Alexander Zonchick. Alexander, was your mom always in awe of your musical career?
Well, she was always in awe of anything her two boys did. Let me just start with that. It never mattered what we did, even if it was not a good thing. She would champion it, you know, whether it was me or my brother. It was always the same. I have a great story with her and my brother, where my brother was the first guy in our family to own a car, and it was a Corvair. And I remember some relatives coming over, and we're all in the room, and they go, "How's Alec? Oh, he's great. He plays the guitar. Go get the guitar. I'm about to play never on Sunday." And go, "How about Costa? How's Costa doing?" "Costa has a car now." And they goes, "No, he has a Corvette." And I go, "Mom, it's not a Corvette. It's a Corvair. Corvair, Corvette. What's the difference?" So that's my mom. She championed everything we did. And as far as the music thing goes, yes, she was supportive. Yes, she loved everything we did. I was never, ever sure she knew what I did for a living. Quite seriously, she didn't really quite put it together. You know, those folks that came out of the war would have been happy if I would have just stayed home. Seriously. She loved the idea that I traveled around the world and did all these great things. But she'd have been just as happy if I would have stayed there and ate her cabbage rolls. I mean, that was the era she came out of. But I know where you're going with this story, right, Jack? You want to hear? You know, this is just one of those moments where it was almost like she was like a firm. It was, "Oh, so you are in the music business." I had played a concert for my friend Bob James in Marshall, Missouri, which is a small little town. And ironically enough, that small little town had an orchestra. It had the Marshall Philharmonic Orchestra. It was a phenomenon that a small town like that even had a symphony. And it was conducted by a guy named Harold Lickey, who gave his whole life to having a community orchestra. And there was a series there. And Bob James asked me if I would do him a favor. Would you do me a favor and go back to my hometown and play a solo with the orchestra? You know, and I had already gone there with Bob and met Harold Lickey. Loved Harold Lickey. As far as the level of the orchestra goes, the accomplishment wasn't in what they sounded like. It was the mere fact that they had an orchestra. It was unbelievable to me. So I book a concert there to play with them, to come in and play some Mozart, which was really challenging. I get the poster in the mail. And I've got this poster. And then I go and I play the concert, and I come back with that same poster and all these flyers. And the day after I get back, I go over to my mother's house. And on that poster is a list of the people who have played with the orchestra. Well, one of the people that played with that orchestra was Lawrence Welk's famous accordion player, Myron Florin. I didn't play with Myron Florin. I wasn't on the stage with Myron Florin. He was one of the three concerts on the poster. So here's my picture. Here's Myron Florin's picture. And here's another guy who could have been Joe Schmuckatello. I don't know who the other guy was. Maybe you know Joe. So I go by my mother's one afternoon, and we always, the minute you walk in the house, of course, it's the same thing. Are you hungry? It's all food, you know. Would you like a snack? And then, you know, here comes the 10-course dinner. And while we're talking, well, what have you been doing? Well, I just got back from Marshall, Missouri. It was so charming. I played in this little town. And I go, look, Mom, here's the poster from this orchestra. And she looks on that poster, and when she sees Myron Florin's picture on there, she goes, you played with Myron Florin? I goes, well, I didn't really play with Myron. You were on the same stage as Myron Florin, and that was it. It was like I met the Pope. It was unbelievable. And in her mind, it goes, "Oh, you are doing so well." And that was I was confirmed at that point, you know, because this is a pretty good career, you know.
I don't know if you ever met the Pope, but when you meet the Donald Trump, I guarantee you what he's going to say is, "How do I get hair like you got?"
Well,
how do you get that hair?
Jack, now, first of all, I'm going to start. I know you're not trying to intentionally insult me, but you're not comparing my hair to Donald Trump's. That looks like a piece of lettuce on his head. Come on now. That's not hair. I mean, God love the guy with all that money, quite seriously. Don't you think with that kind of money you could have a whole head installed? Okay. You know what? This is a mere morsel of the hair I had when I was a kid. You know, hair and actually for the longest time, as you probably know, the mustache, that was the caricature, you know. We all have our shtick. You know that Kenny G and hair is important. Chuck Mangione used to always wear this hat. And, you know, for me, it just became part of my whole thing. And I'm just glad I still have. I think I had enough that it's going to last. 30 more years, who cares?
How do you explain the magic of music? It's the universal language.
You know, the best way to explain it is probably to try to paint a scenario where we don't have it. You know, just try to imagine our world without that music that you remember from the wedding. And in my cases, I've been lucky enough to play weddings and funerals and you name it. Music is so important. It's the soundtrack to all of our lives. It's totally the soundtrack. It hits nerves. It's sad. It makes us sad. It makes us happy. I can't in my wildest dreams imagine a life without music. And in my case, of course, I can't imagine doing anything but this. You know, it became very clear to me. I was doing an interview once with someone, and when they asked this question of me, it was so profound. I got sad for a minute. But the question was, well, if you weren't a musician, you know, what would you be? And I'd go, and it just came out as natural. I'd be really sad. I can't even imagine not being. What would you be? I goes, there's never been a plan B. For me, from the time I was 8 years old, there never was one. It was just there. And so when I take that and now I go through my life, early on, it's a kind of a selfish endeavor. You're doing it for yourself early on. You don't realize that you're ever going to touch anyone. I mean, I had no idea later on that what I did and making music and everything could mean so much. So when you try to explain the magic of music, in my case, I've seen it. I've seen what it does. It transforms people. I see what happens when a whole lot of people come in the room collectively to see one artist, and you kind of take them on this little ride. So, boy, there's the magic as far as I'm concerned. You know,
what do all great entertainers have in common?
Passion, for sure. You know, I've always when I speak with young kids and they don't do this intentionally, they'll say, "Boy, I really like playing the guitar," and I said, "Well, you got to get to the point where you really love playing the guitar, because you got to love it. Can't like it, you know." I think the passion, for sure. You know, when we see a whole lot of artists, whoever they are, I've been lucky enough to meet so many of them, Kenny's a great example. Irvin Monroe is a great example. Bob James is a great example. I book all these incredible artists, Al Jarreau's, Will Downing's. And the one thing that they all share in common, forget their success, and yes, some of them have had some real monetary success. They all have this incredible passion for what they do. They love it, and it's totally them. I mean, it's what's in common with all of them? I love using that word passion. I have a CD called Passion, and it's... that, to me, is the word right there. That's what they all have.
If you want to learn more, www.zonjic, ZONJIC.com. And he's performing at Shadello in Elmer, Ohio, on August 15th and 16th. And then he's got the Shoreline Jazz Festival in Muskegon, Michigan, August 22nd to 23rd. www.zonjic.com. You mentioned passion. And I quote you now, there is nothing more overrated than natural ability. Passion and hard work always win out.
Always, always. And it's, now I'm not suggesting that I don't know musicians who luckily enough have all of it. I mean, I look at Bob James and his perfect pitch, and I look at some musicians that I know who grew up in households with professional musicians and those incredible examples around them. But in the end, you know, when you look, you interviewed Kenny G. You know this is a guy who could retire tomorrow and practices every day, you know. So it really is the passion. I found that I didn't know I had it. You know, it's very funny. When I got accepted into university and I went in there to that first day at band class, everybody in that orchestra to me was ahead of the race as far as I was concerned. I thought they all had this amazing natural ability. I thought they were all, I said, you know what? Yeah, I know how I'm going to stay in this environment. I'm going to work harder than them because I don't have their natural ability. And what do you find out later when you start meeting great musicians? They all have that little insecurity. Boy, insecurity can be such a valuable tool just to have a little bit of it. And then the next thing is you got to work hard at. In my mind, sometimes that natural ability can be a handicap. It comes too easy too soon. And then later on, when that work ethic has to kick in, you know, you can be the greatest musician in your class. You can be the greatest musician in the little dorm room when there's a piano in the corner. But if you want to be a world-class musician, you want to do this for a living, work on a really high level, you got to work so hard. And the musicians I meet, not a lot of them have this, you know, I didn't just pick up that flute and start playing. I couldn't get a note out of it. I mean, I wasn't a natural guitar player. It was the passion. You know, I loved doing it. And then in the end, you know, my son is an actor. He studies drama. And of course, when he's growing up and he's asking the idea of being in theater, he's been in theater since he was a kid, how is a dad who plays the flute for a living going to say it's not a very good idea? Because he would say to me, come on, Dad, you're getting away with that. Why can't I get away with this? And my standard line to him was always the same. Yeah, you can avoid a real job. You absolutely cannot avoid real work. It's just not going to be possible. So as long as you can embrace the concept of how hard you're going to have to work to do what you love to do for a living, then it's all going to work. So
here's Little Sunflower with Kenny G and Alexander Zonjic. Sunflower, Kenny G, Alexander Zonjic. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula, this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Alexander Zonjic, who in 1972, at age 21, bought a flute, probably hot, from a street person for $9.
Probably hot.
Detroit, the D, has been and continues to be one of the greatest musical cities in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's I think it's in the DNA. I mean, you just look at the history. It's everything. It's about its diversity. It's about where it is. It's on a border. We could go on and on and on. I always tell folks when I was, you know, there was a period of time in the 80s where I really thought everyone said, well, you're going to have to go to New York and you're going to have to go to LA. And for me, it was always Detroit. You know, and it's and then you look at what's come out of this city, and in spite of all the other things we read about, it just drives me crazy to see the bad press on it. When I traveled around the world for so many years, and a great example, as I mentioned earlier, that wonderful experience I had with Bob James playing at Carnegie Hall. When I played Carnegie Hall, which by the way I can barely remember doing it, I was so nervous. But when he introduced me, I love Windsor, and I want everyone in Windsor to know that it's still my home and it's still very important to me. But certainly, as far as my career goes, it was Detroit that we looked at. But when we would travel around the world, including Carnegie Hall, and Bob would say, "And ladies and gentlemen from Detroit," it was like a qualifier. It was a credential, you know, because everyone knew. Well, this is where all the great jazz is. This is where Motown comes from. This is where they have a world-class symphony orchestra. There's just so much about Detroit that makes it the city that you referred to. I think it's the greatest music city in the world. My latest CD, no longer new, Doing the D, is doing cool things in Detroit. And it was a tribute to Detroit. Flat out, I made that clear when I made the record. I started asking all my friends, my famous friends, to play on it. Kenny G, Bob James, Jeff Lorber went on. Will you play on this CD? Because I want this to be a tribute to this. I wouldn't have a career today if it wasn't for Detroit. I really feel honored because, you know, I always have to explain to people, I got a green card here. I mean, sometimes, you know, the grass is always greener. I think people in the city, yeah, they love it. I think they know it. But coming from another country, coming from another city, I love telling them, nah, you don't get, I never take it for granted that they even let me in here. I'm surprised they haven't kicked me out, to be quite frank with you.
www.zonchick.com. If you want to see him perform August 15th and 16th in Elmer, Ohio, Shadello, and then August 22nd, 23rd in Muskegon, Michigan, the Shoreline Jazz Festival. The late, great Robert Schuller was famous for his possibility thinker's creed. When faced with a mountain, I will not quit. I will keep on striving until I climb over, find a pass through, tunnel underneath, or simply stay and turn the mountain into a gold mine with God's help. You live that. You are an optimist's optimist.
Really?
You told me to say that.
I love that. I know it's real. You know what? I was taken by, very well read, by the way, Jack. You've obviously read that before. You know what's really interesting is the old cliche where it's really not. I always tell folks that this is not a race we're ever going to win. I'm not going to win this race. I'm never going to be the greatest flute player I'd like to be, because the better I get, it's like they keep moving the finish line. You know, the harder you do. So when I speaking to this here, it's never ever been above, below. It's you keep on moving. And yes, there are obstacles always. We could do a whole show on my failures. I've got a garage with a filing cabinet full of rejection letters from record companies. I got rejection letters from record companies where they even put somebody else's record in the envelope. They forget it's not even mine. And I could tell you about the first time I went into Harmony House Records here. Carl Tom, sweetest man in the world, looked at me. I brought my record in. He goes, would you please put these in your store? He goes, why would I put these in your store? Nobody even knows who you are. And I said, well, they're going to know once you put this thing in there. And he said, how much money did you spend to make this record? I goes, I spent $18,000. He goes, can I give you some advice? You'd have been better off to buy lottery tickets than make this record. I said, I don't want to buy lottery tickets. I want to be an artist. That wasn't an obstacle to me. I left. I said, what is it going to take for me to get my records in your store? We need to hear your music on the radio. You know, the first person that ever played my music on Detroit radio was in these studios, was in WJR. It was Jay Roberts, 1978.
My hero as a kid was Ernie Banks, the late, great Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub. And his enthusiasm, his love for life, his zest for life was so strong that whoever was around him were mesmerized by that while they were around him. They could have been having the worst days, but Ernie just made you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You have that same magic.
Do I know that? You know, if no
every time I've seen you around these 70 and 80-year-old women, it's magic. How?
You know, look, I mean, don't you think that's all a product of being lucky enough to do what you love to do for a living, and to be healthy, and to be and to grow up in a great environment like this. I'm every time I answer the phone half the time, how are you doing today? Living my dream, it's not, sometimes we get in the trenches, but I think everything it really has to do, that happiness has to do with the fact that you really do genuinely love what you're doing. And to be in front of audiences, many years ago, I thought it was the booking agent. I thought it was the record company executive. I thought it was the club owner. I thought those are the people that I got to impress. And those are the people that are going to give me a career. And then later on in life, what do you find out? It's all those people in the crowd. They're the ones that give us the living that we have.
Last night I got a call from Manny Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge. And he says, Jack, I understand you're having Alexander on the show. That man has gone over that bridge so many times in his life. We're going to rename the bridge the Zonchik Bridge. Do you know every toll taker on that bridge?
I have a lot of respect for them, and I do know many of them. And in as much as we're friends, I never play that card, by the way. When you pull up, it's still yes, sir, no, sir. And then they're the ones that break the ice and go, where are you playing now? My mother loves your music. Hey, we saw there's a billboard right now between on the Canadian side of the tunnel with these festivals that I'm doing. And when I go through sometime, and they're looking at my picture all summer. And when I go through the one, they'll look at me and they'll go, what are you doing? Where are you going? And they go, boy, we're getting tired of staring at your big old face up there. And I have a lot of respect for them, and I love the idea that this country, and I don't want this to sound, like I'm patting an entire country on the back now, but I wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for the ability to come over here and work in America. America's been everywhere. I love Canada. I really do. I can't imagine anything cooler than us being on this, in this border, and these two cities that love one another, have a mutual history and everything like that. So make a long story short, yeah, those are my buddies out there.
As our time winds down together tonight, what advice would you give our young listeners?
Well, we touched on so much of it. When you go through an interview like this, and it's a fairly long interview, and you start talking about the passion and the hard work and all of that, it really does boil down to the idea of just loving it, not having a preconceived notion of what it's going to bring you. I think a lot of things that handicap young kids is this idea that I'm going to play the saxophone, I'm going to play the flute because I want to be famous and I want to be rich. Totally the wrong reason, If you really, really love doing it, you're doing it. And by the way, I also like to encourage people who don't necessarily do this for a living. Some of the best musicians I know, Jack, they're doctors. They're people, they're hobbyists, so to speak. And they function on a really, really high level. I can't imagine it. I don't care if it's stamp collecting or collecting baseballs. You know anybody that would do that, Jack, by any chance? But I don't care what it is. These are passions that we have. They make our lives richer and everything. Just love what you're doing. Go about it. But you know what? The hard work thing, I'll tell you, nothing makes this more fun than being good at it. Really, it makes it fun. I'm sure you've interviewed enough people to know. Because I know Kenny, that's his whole philosophy. He loves being, and I'm talking Kenny G, loves being in game form. Mo Kaufman, the great flute player in Canada, who was another almost mentor of mine, said, I have to practice because if I don't practice, I feel I can tell. And then if I stop practicing a little longer, my band members can tell. And then if I stop practicing longer, the audience. Do it because you love it, but work hard at it.
Alexander Zonchik, it's an honor to call you friend and to learn from you and just be around you for years and years and years.
Well, you've been a thrill, Jack. You and I, we've got stories.
We're like twins.
Thank
I'm
you.
The before, he's the after.
Thank you so much.
Please, Jack, join us next on the Until Then. I'm Jack Rasool. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn. Believe in yourself.